The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So the Lojong teachings, training in compassion, as we march forward into life during this winter training period, our coming and going Sesshin, such a wonderful sense of, for me, of Sangha. And Sangha not as something that has a boundary of you're out and or you're in, but I think this larger sense of Sangha that we all are doing exactly our best, and that all of us join together, and each one of us honoring the shape of our life here in America. American Zen, this new experiment, something new in the history of Zen, is this lay practitioners who are meditators. This was actually not so in China as it arose, and not so in Japan or Korea. But here, in the late 50s and early 60s, when Shinrui Suzuki was in San Francisco serving a Japanese Buddhist congregation, there were some crazy Americans who wanted to learn how to meditate. You know, it was those days, the crazy hippies. Some of us survivors of that epoch, participators. We've cut our hair a little shorter and our tie-dyed t-shirts mostly full of holes now. But still, maybe some of us in this room have that spirit. Maybe all of us have that spirit. The summer of love, the life of love, all of us longing to let our hair down. I cut it very short, so easy to let it down. My hair is always down. Learning to live a life, an exposed life, we might say. The great wisdom of the 60s, of course, many things we got wrong in those days, and many understandings of freedom that turned out not to be true. But some spirit of liveliness, of not wanting just to follow along, of wanting to live vividly and fully, not just fulfill some expectation for ourselves. And I think all of us that come to Zen, whatever age or epoch we grew up in, all want this. This is, as Alan said last night, the path of liberation. And on the surface side, liberation can look like I get to do whatever I want. And of course, this isn't true. It isn't true because we are not a separate individual. We've been speaking this whole retreat about this web of life, this fabric of compassion, of bodhicitta, this oneness that is a part of the truth of this moment, this oneness that appears in the universe in the particular form of you or of me. One of you asked me, or someone asked me a few days ago, if everything is empty, if everything is coming and going, if everything is a dream, why do you pay attention to what people say in the Dharma dialogue? Yeah, that's a dream. That's a dream. No, that's another dream. We pay attention because this vast fabric of life must appear in the particular. There is no vast fabric of life that does not appear in the particular. So the very question or concern or word that arises is the vastness of life. This is quite something to feel our way into, and I think one of the geniuses of Zen in particular is this both and, that to come down on one side or the other is not helpful. We say it has no power for the way. So deep insight and merging, that sense of all one body, and there are states of mind where we enter, as we say, the Dharmakaya, the great illuminating darkness, and we can participate in this suchness that Melissa was talking so wonderfully about yesterday. But this is not the goal of our training. The goal of our training is not to disappear. But the goal of our training is to be ourselves. So out of this vastness, out of these experiences, then we can see and appreciate the particular. And these Lojong teachings are quite wonderful pointers for meeting the particular as the way itself. And these are called training. Norman Fisher's book, which we're weaving in and out of, training in compassion. Trungpa says, training the mind. This training is part of our practice. And earlier today in our sutra service, we read an excerpt from some writing by Chenul. Chenul was a 12th century Korean Zen master, roughly contemporary with Dogen. And a great synthesizer. One of his great roles was bringing together. At that time, Korean Buddhism was quite split, and at various times Zen has been split, and one of the big splits is sometimes this sense of a sudden and gradual awakening. And in the history of Chinese Zen, in the, I think, 10th, 11th century, there was a seemingly a great war. Some people saying, no, awakening is a sudden thing, and awakening is a gradual thing. But Chenul said, no, two mints in one, both, both, and this... The suddenness is exemplified in the Rinzai part of our heritage, and the Rinzai part of practice, not a sectarian approach, but the Rinzai understanding and energy is a wholehearted throwing ourselves into the great matter. Who am I? What is this? This vow to wake up, and this these experiences that we all have, these sudden awakening, and these awakenings can be small or large, or short or tall, They come in all flavors and tastes. But they are these moments of seeing through. And in this sudden school, there is this emphasis on prajna, this wisdom. The bodhisattva of wisdom is depicted, Manjushri, holding the sword in his hand. The sword that cuts through delusion. The sword that kills delusion and gives life to awakening. And in our school, we appreciate these awakenings. Chanul says that there are these awakenings and that they are important, available at any time, right here. And then he takes up gradual awakening, gradual cultivation. And we might think of gradual cultivation as training. That there is this aspect, he says, even though we wake up and we know this is it, he says, the beginningless habit energies are extremely difficult to remove suddenly. So they must continue cultivation, they, you, me, while relying on this awakening. We must continue cultivation. We must continue training while relying on this awakening. Through this gradual permeation, our endeavors reach completion. And then wonderfully, after a long time, we become a saint. I wonder what that means. Have my fingers crossed. Speaking of the power of habit energies, so there are these moments of seeing, and all of us, each one of you, have tasted these. And then we fall asleep again. We're awake, and there is this moment, oh, I see, finally I see. And then it gets a little foggy, and then a little more foggy, and then it's, oh yeah, I used to see, I know, or I thought I knew, and then we get confused again, and we are taken away by habit energy. So some of the neuroscience research I know is talks about these habits of mind, or these circuits that fire, you know, I always do it this way, you always do it that way. That once a neural circuit is made, if we try to take it apart or break it up, we actually give more energy to it. It's a little bit like that woven finger trap where you stick one finger in each side of the woven tube, and the tighter, the more you pull, the tighter it gets. So as we sit, one of the real challenges is we begin to see how much time we spend in whining and complaining. We begin to see the mind is in love with its puppet show. And perhaps begin to see that the puppet show is actually not so interesting. Oh, it's the same thing playing at the matinee again. Can't they show something else at this theater? Same theme again and again. I've seen this before. Yeah, now. So we get familiar with that habit energy. And we've been talking about how to meet this habit energy. And this is the training. This is the gradual cultivation. Because when we meet something, so some awareness comes up and we see, oh, here's what I do. Almost immediately there is this, and I don't like it. Here's what my mind does, and this really shows that I'm not a good Zen student, or how come after all these years I'm still this, still that? So the tendency when awareness comes to these patterns, and so important to see the power we're fighting against, until if we underestimate the power of habit force, if we underestimate the power of delusion, we will be very discouraged. It seems like it shouldn't be so hard just to follow my breath. Breathe in, breathe out. How hard could that be? Well, you know, right? You know. I know. This mind, the wildness of mind, the aversive nature, the complaining nature of mind is powerful. It will do everything to avoid, to sustain itself, we might say. So when we see that pattern, for most of us, the first thing is aversion. So we either want to fix it, a kind of aggression, like, let me change this, let me, you know, fix myself. And we say again and again, our practice is not self-improvement. It's not that you won't grow in love and understanding, because I do deeply believe that this simple practice of sitting still and upright in the middle of our life, that in some mysterious way, this is so deeply powerful. So I do think there is transformation, and we do transform, and there is liberation. It's just that's not the point. If we do it in an instrumental fashion, I will do this so that I will have better concentration, or I will accept this so that it will go away. We don't get the full benefit. This tendency toward fixing, which is a kind of aggression, running away, pretending it doesn't happen, this is what we habitually do. And if you fight with your delusion, you are strengthening it. So this is the neural circuit. If I try not to be angry, that I'm really tired of being angry, and I'm angry at being angry, then I'm actually just creating more energy, more thoughts. I will stop my thoughts. All right, I'm stopping my thoughts now. There are no more thoughts. See, look, there are no more thoughts. I'm just here sitting. It's so wonderful. Endless. So this gradual cultivation, this training of the mind, is training in doing nothing. Training in the possibility of some new choice. This choice of letting things be. And as we bring our awareness, as you bring your awareness to whatever the content of your life is, the teaching is that everything, when I look deeply into the real form of the universe, everything reveals the mysterious truth of the Tathagata. So where is it? Where is it? It is the breath within the breath. It is before you take one step. No need to go anywhere. Within these places, these habitual reactivity lies what we are looking for. I took a workshop a number of years ago with a wonderful potter from Minnesota named Linda Christensen. And at the beginning of these kinds of workshops, often the teacher will go around and ask people, you know, what are you working on, you know, what things like that. And she said, what I'm interested in is, where are you stuck? I don't want to know what's going well. I want to know where you're stuck. She said, because the job of an artist is to be stuck in interesting places. The job of an artist is to be stuck in interesting places. And I think we might change that a little bit and say, the job of the artist, the job of the seeker, the Zen student, is to be interested in the places she is stuck. These stuck places that arise so clearly as the problem. And we're exploring now point three in the Lojong teachings, transform bad circumstances into the path. These stuck places that appear as what is wrong with me. And they appear in all kinds of guises, and they appear in particular forms for each one of us. And this radical teaching of Zen and of Buddhism is that these places where we are stuck are the places of great energy, of great possibility. And they are so hard to stay with because we go unconscious. We turn toward them, and who was the figure that you couldn't look directly at this mythological figure, because if you looked directly at it, you would be taken in. And so we come to these habitual places, and we are then taken over. We go into an altered state. One Buddhist friend of ours calls these realms. We go into a realm. And a realm is a mental state that is perfectly self-justifying. It is the ancient story you carry about yourself. I am like this. And it could be a story. I am a kind person. And I look at all these things I can find. See, I did this. I can't believe that you would question that I am a kind person. Or it could equally well be, I am a broken person. And look, I can see all the times in my life. See where this is true. I will not hear otherwise. How dare you tell me I'm not broken? We cling to our deluded self, and in these realms, these self-justifying and self-reifying realms, it is perfectly true. And we can feel quite righteous in our own realm. And we can behave quite badly and feel quite good about behaving badly, because it is just true. And so you cannot fight your way out of a realm. And you might have noticed with your friends and your partners that you cannot bring someone out of a realm. If your friend is in a place lost in this self, this kind of autistic self, you can't say, well, no, look, yesterday you were quite kind to... Well, no, you know, don't do that to me. Because I know. So we cannot, you cannot fight your way out of the realm. William Blake said, you cannot storm the gates of heaven. It is not an act of will when we are in these realms, and these realms are no laughing matter. These forces of darkness, these forces of difficulty are wild. And it is wildly hot or cold or turbulent, and feels so true. There is some comfort in these places, because They are our story, and we may hate the story, but it feels some kind of deepest truth. The other day I was speaking, for me there are states of feeling like I am alone. And when I go into this, I fully believe it, and there is a familiarity to it. I can think back being 4 years old, this little boy, and thinking, oh my God, I am alone. There is nobody to take care of me. I have to figure out, and I don't know. And that little boy didn't know, and he was scared, and so I think this is the truth of my life. And so this is the nature of the realm. This is just the landscape. Don't know what it is for you, but there is a sense of faith in these ancient stories, these ancient neural circuits. And the teaching is you cannot get yourself, you cannot fight your way out, you cannot be helpful enough to somebody who's in that, but that these realms are self-releasing. That the nature of the universe is compassion. And that what you should do when you are stuck, when you are stuck in the ancient story, when you are stuck in that unbearable place, the great instruction is to do nothing. Can we stop fighting? Can we stay still, or maybe slow down just a little bit? And this is the turning toward. This is the meeting. This is the mishap, turning mishaps into the path, transform bad circumstances. We transform bad circumstances not by transforming bad circumstances. We transform bad circumstances by sitting upright, by meeting where we are as best we can. One of the encouragements is, and I think Melissa mentioned this the other day, is curiosity. Part of these places of great stuckness, these bad circumstances, our ancient karma, part of the delusion is that I know what this is, that kind of certainty. And so from the practitioner point of view, we get a little curious. So this seems so familiar, but what is there here I've never noticed before? The great poet and also Dr. William Carlos Williams apparently used to make house calls, and he would carry a notebook, it is said, with him. And on the top of the page of the notebook as he went through his day, it was titled, Things I Noticed Today I've Never Noticed Before. Things I Noticed Today I've Never Noticed Before. What a wonderful practice. In this world where the mind imagines, it knows what's going on. To consciously be curious and to stay. The other necessity of transformation, or the requirement, is to stay here. Norman Fisher talks about his favorite quality in practice as he's discussing this transforming bad circumstances, and he says patience. Patience, or we might say acceptance. We might say just stay here. And this is partly how we support each other as we practice. For our practice periods, the bell rings and we vow to sit still. And we support each other. We support each other with our energy, each one of us staying still in the midst of the demons coming. The angels come and serenade us. The demons come and revile us and jump up and down on our head, strangle us and drag us into the bushes. And we vow not to move, and we support each other, and we also have this wonderful peer pressure. Right? It's too embarrassing. Everybody else is still. I think I'll probably die this round. At least I won't be embarrassed. all kinds of motivations. We support each other. But this is a great act of courage and a great act of love. In the middle of the fire, we say the lotus blossoms in the middle of the fire. The fire is your reactivity. The fire is your stuckness, your brokenness. What's wrong with you? This is the energy of your life, and we are redeeming, we are saving all beings, all the parts of ourselves, excluding no part, no energy is not included. And it's not that we should do this for some moral reason, but this very life, these very difficulties are the fire that cooks us. The fire that purifies us, that melts us down, so that at last we can learn to be ourselves, and we can practice, we can train. So every time you come back, we are training ourself. We are, so you cannot interrupt and break apart neural circuits that are already there, but you can create new ways of being. And we are practicing these new ways of being here, breath by breath, in very little ways. But every time we meet our life, cut through the whining and complaining to be present, we are training ourselves. We are gradually cultivating ourselves. So this is a training, and this training is not something to get somewhere else. But this training is the joy, the expression of life itself. So let us enjoy the great misery, the great wonder, this awesome thing called human life. Thank you. So sitting comfortably, in a moment we'll say names and do our Dharma dialogue. Just a reminder that we record these talks so we can share with other people. If you want to say something and not have it recorded, just let us know and we can turn this off. I'm David.
Melissa.
Mike.
Jamie.
Jenny.
Ray.
Susan.
Susan.
Eric.
Brandon.
Pat.
Bill.
Michael.
And Alan.
Celia.
Lara.
I'm Joanne. So, questions, observations, resonances.
Thank you so much. That I think of the storming the gates of heaven. You can't do that. But then I just love the openness of patience and curiosity and wondering. Like it seems like. Can you storm the gates of patience and curiosity at least? Like, is that an intermediate step? Because it seems like there are times when I'm stuck on something and, you know, I can't even bring curiosity to it. But maybe that's easier than than something else, I guess. But like the way to have training is partly training that curiosity and acceptance. And I guess if there are any tips about how to storm that gate first.
Well, there's the sneak attack. Come from the back is always a good.
Well, I think the use of the word tip is very revealing, because we would like there to be strategies, you know. And some of the Lojong teachings really do appear to be offering strategies, you know, like Tonglen, right? But if we see it as the strategy first, rather than the absolute first, then we get lost in what can I do different, and then it's the same thing all over again. So you want to be more patient, right, and more curious. Yeah, get in line. and the thing is that it's that finger trap again. I'm going to be more patient. God damn it! How many times have I said that in my life? I think we have a friend who had a magnet on her refrigerator that said, "I just want to be more patient, and I'm going to, you know, try as hard as I can to change things so I can be more patient." Can you feel the implicit impossibility of that?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the teaching is that patience and curiosity arise after we learn how to be with impatience and boredom. You know, I'm giving opposites of those two things, but you might have a different opposite. You know, but sometimes, because boredom can sometimes feel like, so impatience has a lot of aggression in it, right? So to feel that, to feel those things first, you know, just to be willing to, it goes back to the realm teaching, right? We are in a realm of impatience, or we're in a realm of boredom, or who cares? They're very interconnected, those two. And so I don't know if you said this in your talk, but one of the teachings around realms is that they're self-releasing. Mm-hmm. Right? That we don't do it. And in the depiction of realms in Tibetan Buddhism, because that's where this teaching comes from, we're learning so much about Buddhism, but always filtered through Zen. In all the pictures in the Wheel of Life and Death, where you go into the different realms, there's always a bodhisattva there. You know, there's always some little possibility of remembering that this will cause us to wake up. If it's going to happen, there's going to be this little turning moment in them. And because of our practice of sitting upright in the middle of everything, we're setting up conditions so that will happen. So, so I think the tip is to start where you are, as Pema Chodron says. Really start where you are. And I don't like this, or this is terrible, and I want this to be different, and I just wish it would hurry up. You know, then that little moment of self-release starts to happen. The little bodhisattva part of us goes, wait a minute. Oh, this is the thing I need to learn to rest in. And then it begins to change on its own. So, yeah.
And the other side is that when the volume isn't turned way up, then we can actually practice, patience or curiosity. That there are times when it arises, and when it gets really, you know, when we're really caught in it, you know, maybe not, but maybe it arises, or when in these little ways we can notice how these qualities arise. So kind of, you know, both the can't do it and be where you are. And there is some ways that we can cultivate this kind of gradual cultivation. So yeah.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to become more patient.
Exactly.
But in the meantime,
I really appreciated your talk and the way that you opened up this notion of beginningless habit energies, which, as you may know, is something I've been struggling with a lot at this retreat. But I wanted to push a little against the very beginning of your talk, because and what you said about the absence of lay practice before America, because I had a very different view. And in fact, there's a wonderful koan about sudden enlightenment versus gradual enlightenment that comes out of 10th century China. And one of the main figures in that koan is a guy called Lei Minpong.
Sure.
Yeah. And he was married to someone who coincidentally was called Lei Womenpong. So imagine when they...
What are the odds?
Sweet.
So, this goes all the way back to one of the first... figures in our tradition, before there was a term Chan, was Mahasattva Fu, who wrote those beautiful lines that are in the miscellaneous koans that start, "With hands of emptiness I grasp the plow." That's because he was plowing. He was a farmer. And this was and the Vimalakirti Sutra about the lay follower of the Buddha that had a greater grasp of the teachings than any of the other disciples.
Right.
That was hugely important in China.
Yeah.
And it's been said that, in fact, sudden awakening was developed partly because it had special appeal to lay practitioners, because they weren't going to sit in a monastery for 40 years.
Yeah.
And we can go to Japan, and the founders of No Drama, Kwanami and Sayami, were lay practitioners and students at EQ, and Basho was a great lay practitioner. And so I'm going to stop because I don't want to show off.
Already done.
Too late. Too late.
But I have my own. But what I'm doing is I'm reciting my own mental ancestor dedication to all my lay ancestors, because I'm deeply committed to lay practice.
Yeah.
And so I just want to bring that up. And I think that there's an institutional habit energy in Zen to dismiss this lay tradition, because transmission has so often been on a priestly line. But I just felt that on behalf of my lay brethren and sistren, I don't know what the equivalent of they is, I should speak up for that.
Yeah. Well, and I hear the energy behind what you're saying, and really want to respect that, right? This lineage we inherit has so many sources, and to really name that, from very early on, Lei Minpong and Vimalakirti, great exemplars who were not in the monastic and tied up in all this rigmarole. And I think we are the inheritors of that, and that's sort of woven into our practice. But I appreciate most your energy in this really claiming, which we all need to do. Thank you.
Thank you. And, an insight arose when you were talking that's very much related to this habit mind formation. And I think you just referred to it, that you have a habit mind of around, making sure that the lay practitioners are included in the history. And I think I suddenly saw that maybe in the last couple of hundred years in Japan, there was a different habit mind that excluded those people. And that's what we inherited here in the United States, because most of our teachers were Japanese. Our teachers were Japanese. And so we think we're rediscovering, we think we're discovering something new. Yeah. But it's more of a circular, it's the way history seems to be going from past to present to future, but it's really keeps going into the present from the future and the past. It's more circular than linear, history, life. We make narratives, but they don't really work that way. So this, and I think every Zen practitioner needs to rediscover for themselves with freshness, oh, wait a minute, I value lay practice. I value whatever. The lineage tradition. How am I? Oh, and then we find out, I didn't make this up. This has been going on for centuries. That's so great. So to see where we get caught in, here's the idea, the lay practice has always been there. Here's the idea that we're discovering lay practice for the first time. How great, that's exactly like the realms, right? Exactly like it. And we can find evidence for both and keep saying, no, you guys are wrong. This is the monks of the Eastern and Western Hall arguing about a cat once again, right? Thank you.
Just one other short add-on. One thing I love is just that when I think of all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I think of people who never heard of Buddhism, and so taking that one step further is the farmer somewhere, or the poet who was a Buddha, and I feel like this tradition accepts and values and venerates them equally.
Yeah,
which is a wonderful
important point.
So let's continue to practice as Buddhas and Bodhisattvas.